From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the metaphysical world. But here's what's happening. The man who tried to kill the late President Ronald Reagan is set to go free after a judge has decided to allow the would-be assassin John Hinckley Jr. to live with his mother in Virginia full-time. Hinckley is set to begin his convalescence leave on August 5th. He was 26 years old, Hinckley, then now 61, when he attempted to kill Mr. Reagan outside of the Washington Hilton Hotel on March 30th, 1981. He fired six shots, hitting four people, including Reagan, who was wounded when a bullet bounced off his presidential limo, just missed his heart. Press Secretary James Brady was shot in the right side of the head, sustaining serious injuries. And when Brady died in August of 2014, Brady's death was ruled a homicide. Now listen to this fateful event on March 30th, 1981. I don't know, but why in the world would you let him go? They say he's clinically ready for full-time convalescence leave, and they're going to do that. It's a strange story. In Philadelphia, at the Democratic National Convention, Senator Tim Kaine accepted his party's nomination as vice president while President Obama electrified the crowd with his oratory. Our national correspondent, Joe Gomez, has been with all these conventions. Joe, your take on today's event.
Well, I'll tell you, this was probably one of the best nights for the Democrats they've had so far. And the crowd was packed in like sardines inside the convention center. George, I was on the floor of the convention while Obama was speaking. And you could hear this roar coming out of the audience. It was like a purr almost, like you were at a basketball game. And he gave such a stinging indictment of Donald Trump. The audience was with him the entire way. There was a moment though that he gave a shout out to Senator Bernie Sanders when some chanters said "Feel the burn," and Bernie was actually signing autographs at the time. But the evening capped off with Hillary Clinton coming out on stage, and nobody expected that. Wow, I can't believe it. I mean, that was a momentous night.
And Hillary accepts tomorrow. You'll be there, Joe. We'll get your last report for us, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you. Joe Gomez, get some sleep out there in the city of brotherly love. Dr. John Curtis, of course, onlinecolumnist.com. And also columnist for the Los Angeles Daily Journal, has been monitoring the convention all day long. John, any changes here in your thoughts?
Well, I mean, this night was like hitting Trump with all the big guns. I mean, he was savaged tonight. I mean, and, you know, and especially burned by Michael Bloomberg, you know, a fellow New Yorker and billionaire.
Yeah, he slapped him.
Who is really just, they're appealing to everyone, appealing to the independent vote. That is, that's who Bloomberg appeals to, and he was asking independents to vote for Hillary. Joe Biden delivered one of his kind of classic, you know, just, you know, Biden-esque types of speeches that had the crowd in an utter frenzy. And then Obama tonight rediscovers what he had 12 years ago when he spoke at another convention, I think it was in Boston, for John Kerry, you know, on a keynote address, rediscovering that, you know, that he still has this kind of special charisma. But one of the things that's going to happen, George, is that now that they've launched, and Tim Kaine came out, by the way, the vice president, who, in contrast,
vice president nominee,
in contrast, looked so ineffectual, so wussy, so I mean, just a lightweight compared to the others, that it had to give people second thoughts about this guy's pick. But I think that when you look at the overall effect of this, it's like a fantasy world. It's like the whole Democratic convention. It's just pure fantasy. America is happy. It's never had better race relations. Relations with the police have never been better.
Great music, Broadway.
Terrorism problem in this country. The economy, George, is fantastic. What's everybody complaining about? We have wonderful low unemployment, even though the Federal Reserve Board just announced today that they would not be raising rates for the foreseeable future because the nation's GDP is so flat right now that we're teetering on a recession. In fact, many economists predict a recession in 2017. So what you have with the Democratic Convention is utter pure fantasy that they're feeding not only the crowds at the, you know, and in Philadelphia, but the entire electorate right now. Whereas with the Republican Convention, you could say, oh, Trump was really negative. Really? He's talking about really stuff that's going on, like $20 trillion debt and terrorism washing on U.S. soil, an economy that is flat. So you're really, you know, tonight was the time to put Trump down with the big guns.
Well, and they did. And they did. Okay, we're going to talk to you soon, John. I'm going to get your predictions because I want early predictions from you, and then as we get very close to November 8th. Howard Bloom, of course, an expert on the human mind. Howard, your take on today's action in Philadelphia.
Exercise in optimism, even though there are a lot of problems to overcome. It has star-studded cast again. Barack Obama, as John just said, was absolutely terrific. Bill de Blasio, Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg should know Donald Trump better than just about anybody else on the face of the earth. He was the governor of New York. He was the mayor of New York through three terms. And Donald Trump is one of our most important figures. But Michael Bloomberg pinned the tail on the donkey. He said, this is a con man. You cannot trust him. Then there was Joe Biden, Sigourney Weaver, Leon Panetta. But there were two major themes of tremendous importance tonight. One was gun violence. Among the stars who showed up was Mark Kelly, the astronaut who's just spent a year in space, mm-hmm. and his wife, Gabby Giffords. She knows something about gun violence. She lost a big part of her brain to a bullet. She has... You could see with what difficulty, but what courage she has managed to walk and learn once again to talk, and she did talk. So one of the themes was, let's get rid of this gun violence. Let's decrease the number of guns on the streets. And you had police commissioners coming out and police people coming out and pleading with us to get rid of the guns on the street because those guns are dangerous to them. And the other big issue was, who can handle the commander-in-chief position? There was a video that pointed out that 60 GOP security experts signed a letter saying that Donald Trump is not fit to be commander-in-chief. There was an admiral who called, no, it was Robert Gates, the former head of military for the United States, who's the Secretary of Defense, who said that Trump feels that he has all the answers, and that falls under the category of toxic leadership. There was Admiral John Hudson and Leon Panetta, the former Secretary of Defense and head of the CIA, and these people were making a point that, first of all, our Army coheres because it knows that we have a solid sense of American values. And if you encourage torture, and if you encourage killing the families, the innocent families of terrorists, and if you basically take Donald Trump's approach to the military, you are standing against every principle that Americans fight for, and you will undermine the American military. And the other point they were making is they all know Hillary Clinton. They have all dealt with Hillary Clinton. They've all sat down with Hillary Clinton. They have taught her, and they have learned from her. And they trust Hillary Clinton, and the military, the top guys, do not trust Donald Trump.
All right, thank you, Howard. So tomorrow Hillary Clinton will accept her nomination to run as Democratic presidential candidate, and then the game's afoot, folks. Then you will see one of the most vicious campaigns ever. There'll be several debates, everything leading up to November 8th, and we shall see what happens. The Veterans Affairs Administration spent $20 million on expensive artwork and sculptures amidst all the healthcare scandal, where thousands of veterans died waiting to see doctors. So they're dying waiting to see doctors, and the VA is spending $20 million on artwork. Turkey's government has decided to close down dozens of media outlets, including 45 newspapers, 16 television stations, in the wake of a failed military coup. That'll tell you the direction that country is going. A man in Texas, caught on video, apparently beating a snapping turtle to death with a hammer, claimed he was acting in self-defense, as prosecutors charged him with animal cruelty. Jupiter's great red spot is apparently also red hot. The highest temperatures ever observed on the planet were recently detected in the region right above that huge storm. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Stephen, what do you have for us this week?
Well, hi, George. Beyond the world of politics, there really is something out there in the final frontier. And here we go. The information that I'm about to give to the Coast audience is actually good for Thursday night into Friday morning. And we start off with an amazing meteor shower to open up the summer season. We have the annual Delta Aquarid meteor shower, a fairly strong one. And astronomers are saying that this one should be fairly good, meaning the number of meteors, if indeed you're away from city lights. And, of course, the moon will not interfere. Look into the southeastern sky anytime after 3 a.m. into early Friday morning. And another treat awaits the entire listening audience, George, here in North America. We have a star called Aldebaran, some 65 light years away in Taurus. And every so often, the moon glides by this star. We call it an occultation. But if you live along the line south of El Paso, Lubbock, Texas, Oklahoma City and Tulsa and Oklahoma, St. Louis, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and all those states down toward Florida, you will see around 5 a.m. Central Daylight Time, the moon will literally cover this particular star. If you're on that exact line, you'll see this star grazing across the mountains of the moon, all this with the naked eye and a pair of binoculars. We start off our beautiful Meteor Madness 2, George, here in Arizona. And for folks that would like to attend that, last year we reported live here on Coast.
I remember that.
That was awesome, and hopefully we'll do it again if that's possible. But go to drsky.com. You can find out how to join us for that event if your travels are heading to you to the west. And finally, from the live sky, both Venus and Mercury starting to pop their head up into the northwest. Just after sunset, Venus will start to become the bright evening star. George, so many wonderful things here. As we always remind everybody, always keep your eyes to the skies.
Up next, the Upright Thinkers, our species journey from living in trees to understanding the cosmos. Leonard Mlodinow joins us back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Leonard Mlodinow back with us. Leonard, of course, is a theoretical physicist and author, of course, of several books, including The Upright Thinkers. Fantastic work. He has co-authored a book with Stephen Hawking, of course. It was a number one bestseller. He's also the co-author with Deepak Chopra as The War of the World Views. In addition, Dr. Mlodinow has also written for the series then MacGyver, Star Trek The Next Generation, and he's back on Coast to Coast. Great time to come back on the show, Leonard. Miss you. How are you?
I'm great, George. It's great to be back.
I want to get away from politics for a little bit.
But, yeah, that's something less depressing.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult not to talk about it, but I'm sure glad that we've got this kind of program where we can just let our minds wander for the rest of the show and really get into some of these fun things. Tell me about your latest work, The Upright Thinkers.
Well, I traced the evolution of human understanding of the world from our state of complete ignorance when we were just animals on the African savanna to today's modern science. And so how we looked at the world, how we figured things out, and how we answered the great questions about our place in the universe and what it's all about.
How did this evolution occur to the point where we are right now? I mean, the growth and the scope of that is absolutely staggering.
It really is. I mean, if you imagine yourself out in the field somewhere with, let's say, no education and you're trying to figure out where life comes from and what the stars are and the sun, it's how would you get there? It's hard to imagine, but it took us thousands of years. Really, it started in a way about 10,000 BC when people first started building temples and asking questions about life and death and what happens after we die and what is life about and who controls the world. And over thousands of years, those questions morphed into questions about of a more physical nature. And then the Greeks came and the ancient Greeks, and eventually about 1,500 years after them, we invented the scientific method, and things really started picking up. And the 20th century, with quantum theory, things took off. So it's been quite a journey, and it took a long, long time, and a lot of passionate work by many very dedicated people.
Would you say, Leonard, that our growth has been dramatically fast, or is it pacing out at what you would say would be normal?
No, it's amazing. I mean, it's scary fast. I mean, it really is, because I'm not sure that the human politics, sorry to mention that word, is you know, up to handling the new scientific knowledge that's coming. But the way knowledge works is the new knowledge that you get, the amount of new knowledge that you get at any time is proportional to the knowledge that's already there. The more of a background knowledge you have, the easier it is to create new knowledge. So in science, we call it exponential growth. And people think of exponential growth as meaning fast growth, but it's not really necessarily fast. An exponential starts slowly, and at some point it starts picking up and getting faster and faster. As you build up your, let's say, your knowledge base, the change of knowledge gets faster and faster. And we've reached a time now where it's just mind-boggling. And the amount of power that individual people and governments will have, already do have, but will have in the next 10, 20, 50 years is crazy, and I'm not sure we know how to control it.
Let's talk about some scientific aspects here, Leonard. I'm going to tap into your futuristic mind for a moment. What do you see?
Try and find it.
What do you see on the horizon for things over the next 5, 10, 20 years?
Well, it's very hard to predict what totally new things will come, but one thing you can do, especially in the next over periods like that, is to look at what people are already working on. And there's some pretty amazing things. There's a technology now called CRISPR, for instance, that lets scientists edit DNA. So you can take genes, and just like in a book, you can replace words or move around sentences. You can do that with DNA now. So you could actually design your own creatures. And that's exciting in terms of all the medical research that could come out of it, and it's also scary because you could take, for instance, a person and the DNA of a human, and you can try to alter it to make it better. Not that I'm recommending that, but I'm more worried that people will do that.
And what about mistakes? Oh my God!
Yeah, you can design creatures, but who knows what would come? And so that's a pretty scary one. On the other hand, in medical technology, there's a lot of really exciting new things that go on to help your health. In nanotechnology, that people are working on ways of building little, almost like little machines or little cages that can carry chemicals and target them to cancer cells, to specifically kill cancer cells. There's cell phone sensors that people are working on, that you would have little chips or little sensors in your body that would tell your cell phone when you have cancer or when you have certain infections or your heart disease. So that's pretty amazing. Aging, oh my God, they're making tremendous strides in aging. I mean, right now it's still on the level of fruit flies and rats, so maybe if you have a pet rat, that's good for you.
Yeah, fruit flies don't live very long, do they?
No, a couple of weeks, but they can make them now, I think, live about half a year, so that's an amazing jump. Imagine doing that to people. So we're really understanding a lot in biology. In physics, some of the most exciting things are the exoplanets that we're discovering, looking for life, but for now discovering that there are other planets, and specifically there's other stars like the Sun and planets like the Earth out there, and we haven't found any yet that have life on them, but I personally have faith that there are. I don't have any proof, but
I've got a feeling. It's got to be everywhere. It's got to be everywhere, Leonard.
You would think so, yeah. So that's that's pretty exciting. Augmented reality is a big thing now, not just for games. You know, in games there, of course, there's a Pokemon Go game that's, taken the world by storm.
It's incredible.
They're working on amazing new technologies that can make you seem, right now you watch a movie on the screen, but in the future you'll just feel like you're there. And that was being promised about 20 years ago, but it seems like it's really going to come true in the next, say, 10 or 20.
Will they ever be able to download dreams from us and kind of visualize it on a screen while it's coming right off of your head?
Well, it's interesting. They did an experiment some years ago. They put people in MRI, and they showed them slides, and they had them look at slides, and then they had the computer take the MRI, it's the fMRI, a functional magnetic resonance. It's like the MRI your doctor uses, but it's a little different. It measures the activity of your brain, not just the structure.
Hold on, Leonard. Let's talk more about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're winding down the days until August 27th, our live show event in Asheville, North Carolina. Really looking forward to it with our special guests, ufologist Micah Hanks, William Forstgen on EMP attacks, and paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren, who says he's got a couple secrets up his sleeve. And then we're going to have a major meet and greet after the program. This is what you do. For tickets, go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Click the picture of Asheville, North Carolina event, which you'll find at the highlight reel. And those of you who don't have a computer, here's a toll-free number to call during business hours. Ready? Here it is. It's not toll-free. Sorry. 828-257-4530. That's 1-828-257-4530. And welcome back to Coast, Leonard Mlodinow with us as we talk about his latest work, The Upright Thinkers. Leonard, we're talking about downloading dreams and putting it on video, and you said that there was an MRI test. What happened?
Well, they put people into the machine, and they had them had special goggles, and they were viewing slides. And then the fMRI machine was reading electromagnetic wave signals from their brains and then was able to reconstruct what they were viewing. So the computer made its own guess based on the people's brain waves of what they were seeing. So they were actually, in a sense, reading the minds of these people. And That's the first step. I'm not saying that that's the same as recording dreams, but it just shows you what the potential of that technology is.
That would be incredible. How's Stephen these days, Hawking?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He is amazingly resilient and keeps traveling, and I keep seeing him make the headlines. Moving around the world, he's probably, what is he now, 73, and he keeps on going. He's amazing.
He really is. Amazing how he talked about being very careful to let an extraterrestrial civilization know where we are. I got a kick out of that.
I think he's totally right, too. I look at it this way. Suppose we go to another star system and we find a planet and it has some simple life on it. I don't know what, squirrels, cats, maybe cows. So, you know, maybe not quite those things, but The analog of that. And we make a settlement there. What are we going to do? Well, we're probably going to domesticate them and use some of them for food, you know, eat them just like we do here. And I think that could be what happens to us because When these aliens come, the gap, if they're good enough to come here, the gap in intelligence will make us to be like rats, squirrels, and cows compared to them. So they won't be mean or nasty, but they'll just view us as lower animals to be used as they wish.
Some say it's already happening.
Well, luckily I haven't seen any, but I will duck if I do.
Let's talk about life in the cosmos. Why specifically here on Earth do we have such an abundance of so many different creatures and species? I mean, it's absolutely riveting.
It is, and I think we understand that fairly well. It's just that there are so many different environments, and evolution seems to be able to make some kind of creature that works everywhere. So, you know, there are, if you look under the seas, deep in the ocean where it's extremely cold and high pressure, and you'll find animals, and not just microorganisms, but, you know, giant, I don't know, slugs and strange sea creatures. You'll find them in hot springs, where, you know, at least bacteria, where it's 250 degrees under high pressure. You'll find them in the sky, in the dirt, everywhere where there's organic material. There's evolution seems to be able to make some creature that will operate. The thing we don't understand is how that all started in the first place, because we don't have a very good understanding of how the first macromolecules of life developed. I mean, once we have something as simple as a bacteria, you can understand the diversity of life and the development of intelligence and animals that can fly really fast or whatever else animals can do. But how that first beginnings formed, we don't really understand. And that's why you can't really scientifically say there's probably life elsewhere. When I say that, it's just like my own faith or gut feeling.
Well, you know, I still can't figure out the Big Bang. I just don't get it. I just don't know how something started from nothing.
Well,
you go crazy thinking about it.
You do, and it's hard because our brains, and that's what I was, that's one of the themes of my book, our brains evolved to handle certain situations, and those are the situations that we encountered in the wild. Our brains didn't evolve to handle physics and math and abstract ideas that, like the Big Bang. We can apply the skills that we have to do that, but it's not natural. You can imagine, for instance, two dimensions. If I say imagine yourself on two dimensions, that's like a tabletop. You can do that, right? And you can imagine yourself in three dimensions, where you live in three dimensions, but you can't imagine four. You know, why is that? That's because you have no experience with four.
That's right.
Some other creature that lives on two dimensions, like an ant that just, you know, that can't really get off the surface, can only imagine two dimensions. If you ask an ant to imagine three, the ant would say, oh, that's beyond my powers. So if you have a creature that lives in four dimensions, it would have no problem with the four dimensions. It evolved that way. When we look back at the beginning of space and time at the Big Bang, that involves imagining different dimensions and dimensions being curled around and interacting with each other, and we have no experience with that. So it's very hard to envision.
Well, they say the universe started about 14 billion years ago. So is that relatively accurate, or could they be off by hundreds of billions of years?
No, that there's a lot of different ways to get at that, and that's a pretty serious, accurate, you know, confidence.
So in terms of time, 14 billion years ago, which is nothing in terms of space-time, but 14 billion years ago, this universe that we know of right now started. The question is, what was before that?
Well,
help me.
Ours is probably not the only universe, and it seems that universes can come from nothing. And I know that's hard to understand, but in quantum theory, we have an understanding of nature that's quite different from the understanding you have from your everyday life, that as an animal you get by interacting with the environment. And that all works in the macroscopic world. But when you look in the microscopic world, things are much different, and things can come from nothing, and you know, you've heard of the uncertainty principle. Things aren't really that well defined as they are in Newtonian physics, in everyday physics. You can't say this is something is right here and that thing is there. Those kinds of concepts don't really work. And the thing about the early universe is that as you go back in time, the universe was smaller and smaller and smaller. And if you go back far enough, everything is crushed into such a small area that quantum theory really dominates, and all these crazy laws take effect. And because of that, a universe can come from nothing. But that doesn't really tell you a lot, because you're saying, how can a universe, where did it come from? And I'm saying it comes from what we call a vacuum state.
I mean, I can't even...
nothingness. But where did the state of nothingness come from?
Exactly.
So it's like trying to define God. You can always say, but okay, if God created the universe, who created God? And there's really no answer to that. It's an infinite chain of questions.
Do you think there's something right under our noses, Leonard? It's right there. We just can't see it or pick it up, that answer?
Well, I think that...
Could it be that obvious?
George, you know, another thing I found in writing the book was that all those answers that were extremely mysterious and nobody could see, once someone found them, they're obvious, and you go, oh, that was right under your nose.
Yeah.
Why didn't we get... I say to myself, I could have invented relativity. Why did Einstein have to do it? It's so simple. But before Einstein, it wasn't so simple. But once he came up with it and I read it, then I go, oh, yeah, that's simple. So I think it's all right under our noses. We just haven't seen it yet.
Several months ago, they detected gravity waves backing up Einstein. It was huge news. Tell me the significance of that.
Well, so Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity about 1916, and he worked on it for 11 years. And that's the theory that people generally talk about in science fiction, where space and time is all bent and matter. You know, you have time warps and black holes and all that. And there's only a handful of tests of that theory, because that theory, to see the effects of that theory as opposed to our everyday theory of gravity, just Newton's laws of gravity, you really need very extreme conditions or something very extreme happening. Like one test is you look at starlight that comes just very close to our sun, and the sun, you can see how it bends the starlight, but you can only do that during an eclipse because the sun blinds you if you try and look any other time. So there's only a handful of these, and one of the things that his theory predicted, which he said he thought would never be observed, are these waves of gravity. So just like you have light waves, and then that's what your radio program is sent out over radio waves, which mm-hmm. is a kind of light wave of outside of visible frequencies, just like we have those waves that charged particles make, if you move masses around, you can make gravity waves. But gravity is about 10 to the 40th times weaker. It's extremely, extremely weak, so they're very hard to detect. And what this instrument did was it detected waves of gravitational radiation, which is just like, let's say, the gamma rays equivalent in gravity from black holes that were orbiting, or black hole and a neutron star that were orbiting many billions of years away and fell into each other, collided with each other. And those instruments to detect that are so sensitive that they have to be able to detect changes. Well, when these waves come, they change the length of things, okay, because a wave of gravitational energy, it stretches and it stretches and deforms matter.
And is it like a wave in an ocean?
It is, but the ocean is not an ocean of material. It's an actual ocean of space and time.
Aha, okay.
So it's like a distortion of the framework in which we all exist. But that distortion was less than the size of an atom. So you had something that was over a kilometer long, and it's changing its size less than an atom's length or width diameter.
Huh.
So you can imagine how sensitive that is. And a guy named Kip Thorne, whom I know very well,
from
Caltech, started, and two other fellows started this up in the 1980s. And just look how much dedication and willpower and work was done till it finally reached fruition. And it's not just amazing as a test of general relativity, as a confirmation, but it's a whole new kind of astronomy, because up until now, all our telescopes, first they were optical telescopes, and then they were telescopes that used other kinds of electromagnetic waves, like radio telescopes. But this is a whole other way of looking at the universe through the gravity interactions, through the waves of gravity. So it's a whole, it'll give us a whole new kind of knowledge about the early universe once we get this thing going and start making more observations.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? The things that we're learning all the time.
Well, as a theoretical physicist, what the experimental physicists can do is really unbelievable to me. it's very impressive, and it's miraculous to me. It seems like a miracle that they can make such fine measurements.
Nobody's really talking about string theory anymore. I don't even hear Michio Kaku talk about string theory that much.
Yeah, you know, it seems to have hit a wall, and it's a very interesting theory and with great potential, but they've never been able to make an actual practical prediction. And back in the 90s, it seemed that like that might be coming, and now we're 16 years after the 90s ended, and there's not much coming from that. So who knows if that's really valid? And a lot of physicists are very skeptical of string theory, other than the many who work on it. If you talk to people who don't work on it, they're very skeptical and often actually jealous of the money that pours into string theory too.
Some people have been saying that, because I've always asked that question, what's in a black hole? If you go in there, do you get ripped apart? What happens? Some people are saying now, some physicists, Leonard, that black holes might be popping out new universes. Is that conceivable?
Something like that is, and it's one of the many theories of the origins of universes that we have. And, you know, in the old days, people would get ideas and work on them, but they'd be very reluctant to publicize them and publish them. And now we live in a different world where speculation is very welcome. And I'm not saying that's a good thing, but there are a lot of these different theories out there, and there are various mathematical reasons to think that they may be promising, but there is not evidence for most of them. So it's still an open question.
When you put together Upright Thinkers, and again, the subtitle is important, Our Species' Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos, where do you think we'll be 100 years from now in terms of knowledge?
I don't think I have the imagination to.
Could be amazing.
Say that, yeah. I think in the next 100 years, we'll make enough as many advances as we have in the last 500. So,
wow.
To try and think back to Galileo's day, think back to the 1500s, and what life was like. I mean, virtually no medicine at all. Nothing, we knew almost nothing. Transportation was what, by horse and chariot or something.
Mm-hmm.
No communication. No electricity, right? I mean, look at all that we've done in the last. We've also increased the lifespan from about, I think back then it was probably in the late 30s or 40, and to today it's more than double. So I expect at least that much progress in the next 100 years, because as I said, the pace of knowledge is accelerating. But I don't, it's one thing to talk about technologies that are on the drawing board now, which I was doing earlier, but to guess what totally new things will come, I don't think anybody can do that, because you don't know what they are until you stumble upon them.
What is fueling the incredible knowledge and growth?
Well, really, one answer to that is quantum theory, and that's why I devoted some time at the end of the book to how that was discovered and what it means. But the thing about, up before the 1900s, all our knowledge, every theory, whether it was chemistry or biology or physics, had to do with the macroscopic world that we can see and touch and feel. And around 1900, we began to be able to probe the world that we can't experience, the atomic world, and we found all these new laws. But what that did eventually was enable electronics to come to be invented, integrated circuits, and the kind of technologies now that eventually drove computer technology. And that has really let things take off. So the whole of modern life can, in a way, was revolutionized by quantum theory allowing these electronics to be developed, which allowed Moore's Law to apply starting in the 60s, where we started to miniaturize computers more and more, until today we have cell phones and fiber optics and cable TV and computers and satellites beaming things around the world, and the computers themselves are tools of knowledge, right? Because scientists are constantly using them to analyze and to learn more, and so knowledge keeps building on itself. But it was really waiting for this quantum knowledge to really start this explosion. And, it simmered for a while and really blew up in the 60s and has been, taking off ever since. And especially the last, I would say, 10, 15 years is where it's gotten, really reached that real fat part of the exponential curve, where it's extremely turbulent hurricane of new things coming all the time. You can't keep up. You talk to a scientist, they'll know their very narrow field. And outside of that, they don't know that much more than a layperson, because you just can't keep up.
They say that monkeys that they found and discovered remnants used tools. Amazing.
And even crows. Some crows, they found animals, as we're getting all this new knowledge, we're throwing out some of our old knowledge, which, as it turns out, wasn't really knowledge, but they were just beliefs that we had. And it turns out that a lot of animals, not just humans, can use tools, certain kinds of simple tools. And I think when people say that humans are the only ones who do this or that, we should take that with a grain of salt. They may be the ones who do it the best, the most sophisticated, but only is a tough word, because there's really a whole spectrum in nature. And a lot of creatures we think of as being simpler have abilities that people don't realize.
We're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls next hour with Leonard Mlodinow. Those of you who are into science, into physics, well, this is your night. The book is called The Upright Thinkers, and the book, Leonard, is available where? All over the place?
Everywhere, yep.
That's the way to do it. And the website, of course, is his name, which is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. So make the calls. We'll be ready in a moment. Those of you who are into hard science, this is your night.